Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome back to What Went Wrong. This is the second half of our coverage of John Singleton's Boys in the Hood. If you missed part one, give it a listen and then circle back for part two. And without further ado, I give you Boys in the Hood. If you're going to make a movie about South Central, John Singleton was insistent, we have to shoot the movie in South Central. So there were three major consequences to this decision. First of all, they were going to shoot in relatively uncontrolled environments. They ended up using both the LAPD and the Fruit of Islam as security. And if you guys remember, Spike Lee actually used Fruit of Islam for security on Do the Right Thing. And they are the like security side of Muslim Brotherhood. They would be shooting next to basically many of the homes of the cast and crew members. And I think, John, you guys talked about, like, Nia Long had a comment, like, she could have walked to set, but she didn't walk home from set, like, one or two times on the film.
Right.
Here's the real benefit, though. Who do you not want to come to set when you're shooting a movie?
The studio. They're not going to show up.
Yeah. So the studio just never came.
Where is it? Oh, nice. Good for you guys. We had meetings. We have a couple of meetings.
We've blocked out our calendars for the next 38 days. But we will see you guys at the wrap party. Oh, no, it's going to be down there too? Okay. So they have a 38-day shoot. And we've talked about this before. They're going to shoot it chronologically so that Singleton can just focus on telling the story in order across the movie. So we'll start with them as kids. We'll do the middle act when Doughboy comes back, and then we'll build to all the action so we can shoot all the action last, basically, at the very end of the movie. And Singleton himself said the audience should be able to feel the movie grow stronger from a technical perspective as it goes on, because he was improving as a director as he was shooting the film. He was basically learning how to direct as he was shooting the movie. Although you guys talk about the first shot in this movie is great, and the stop sign. Like the slow push-in on the stop sign with airplane going overhead.
Yes, yeah.
And it is a great first shot. And I was like, did they shoot that first? Or did he like pick that up later? You know what I mean? When he learned more of what he was doing. Now, John Singleton was very confident, but he was nervous. And one piece of evidence that he was nervous, apparently he just was shooting one take per setup at the beginning of the shoot because he was so scared that they were going to go over. So like they would just do the setup. He would roll it. Cut, we're moving on.
Oh, God.
And the producer was like, oh, okay, like, I guess we got it. And then he did it three times. And Steve Nicolaides went up to him and he was like, you know, you're allowed to do more than one take, just so you're aware. And then he calmed down a little bit. Apparently, hilarious. He also sent the script to John Hughes to read and give feedback.
Makes sense.
I don't know what feedback he gave, but he was a big fan of John Hughes movies. And he was like, this is a teen movie. Can you give me some feedback? Also interesting, given what we learned about John Hughes and his early background as a screenwriter in our episode on The Breakfast Club. Check that out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Singleton wasn't the only one learning while they were shooting. Fishburne was the veteran actor on set that many of the young cast looked up to. Although, how many years older do you guys think he was than his on-screen son, Cuba Gooding Jr.?
8, tops. 9.
John?
Oh, yeah, let me think. Well, yeah, because Cuba's probably like 23, Fishburne, maybe 7?
6 years.
Yeah. 6.
Yeah, it's pretty tight. And I think Angela Bassett's 5. I can't be sure.
They do that. They do that. Like in The Preacher's Wife, I feel like there's like a grandma and like her age, and like it's like she's supposed to be the mother to Whitney Houston, and their age difference is like 5 years. It's like,
yeah. There's a number of those. I mean, even if you look at like Indiana Jones Last Crusade, I think Sean Connery and Harrison Ford are about 10 years apart in that movie.
Right.
What are you going to do? I also think it makes sense here because they start when the parents are young.
Yes.
Because the kids are young. Like you said, it's not 10 minutes of them as kids.
No, it's a lot.
It's a full 35 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Of them as kids. So you have to cast with both of those in mind. Also, Lawrence Fishburne, who is extremely handsome, also looks a little older than 29 in this movie.
He does. He definitely looks older than 29. And he has the gravitas of an older man as well.
Yes, absolutely.
I will say, one of the only things about this movie I initially had a bit of a hard time like buying was that Cuba Gooding Jr. could be a teenager. Like, I understand he wasn't even that much older. It's just that he does look a lot older. And the way that he carried himself, too, I was confused for a minute because I was like, are they in their 20s? And then it was like, no, they're 14.
There was a little bit of that, like, hello, fellow kids, like, yes, vibe when he first shows up at the house party. I agree.
Yeah, you're like, 17? Really? Okay.
like a couple years ago? But yeah. Because Morris Chestnut does look like, oh, he's like senior high school football player. Like, I could believe that.
Especially because he's a football player. Like, exactly. Because he's an athlete, you're like, okay, they're bigger, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Even Ice Cube, I could buy as being like, you know, 18, 19.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the only one.
Yeah, well.
Whatever.
Most of the way there. It's not like Greece.
No, they're not 45 I mean? In high school. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Greece. Goodness.
Well, it is funny you talk about Cuba Gooding Jr. looking older because apparently Morris Chestnut was very nervous and was like, Cuba Gooding Jr.'s done a pilot. I need to like get all the advice from this guy on how to act in this movie. Apparently, he badgered him so much that according to Chestnut, quote, one day he came out of his trailer and I happened to be coming out of my trailer and he pretended like he had to go back into his trailer to get something just to avoid me.
Oh, that's hilarious. No.
So the shoot was relatively smooth. It did run into a few snags. So tensions did run high between the production and some members of the community, including some gang members who threatened to bring violence to the set. Cuba Gooding Jr. did describe. So there's that scene where they're running on top of the wall. You guys remember in the third act, they're like cutting behind the houses to get to the alley. Those dogs were uncontrolled. So the dogs that are jumping up, I believe those were just dogs that lived there. And so Cuba was like, if we had fell and tripped, they would have fucking chewed us up, me and Morris. And then, of course, even though John Singleton never specifically name checks the Bloods or the Crips in the movie, there are red and blue vibes to the two different gangs. And things came to a head when Steve Nicolaides got a word that, quote, a guy named Bone, who runs the Bloods in an area they call the Jungle, which was right across the street from where they were going to do a scene where Ice Cube shoots. It's where he takes revenge on the three guys that killed Ricky.
Yeah, it's like the burger parking lot.
Exactly. So that was going to be a shot in a different location. So Nicolaides meets with Bones. Bones says, I hear your movie is dissing the Bloods. And he's like, we're not dissing anyone, which, by the way, John Singleton's whole point of the movie is there's no good guys or bad guys. The whole point is to show that the system's causing this like cycle of violence. But Bones is like, look, I hear Ice Cube's going to be wearing a blue Detroit Tigers hat, and the bad guy's got a red Chicago Bulls hat on and drives a red car, and that sounds like dissing to me. And then he left him with an implicit threat. He said, I can't stop some 14-year-old walking up with a 9mm and shooting Ice Cube in the back of the head if you're going to shoot right across the street from me. So Nicolaides goes to Singleton, and Singleton's like, he's not going to do anything. like, this guy's no one, like, he's not going to do anything. And Ice Cube's Ice Cube's like, hold on a second.
Wait. My life is on the line. Yeah.
He said shoot me in the back of the head.
Yes, Ice Cube's like, he might do something.
And Ice Cube's like, I'm about to be the most famous rapper on the planet. I'm not trying to get shot right now. So they changed the location. And that location that they shot at, in the end, is the Eat a Burger at the Crenshaw Mall, which is a couple miles away. They had no problems shooting there. They ran over production a couple days. Apparently that house party, the welcome home, or the street party scene turned into an actual block party. That's the one where they pull out the Mac 11 at the end and fire in the air. The production, though, wrapped on budget. And actually, dailies had generated such a buzz that some production executives from the corporate offices had finally ventured south of Culver City during the final week of production to visit the set. So some of the publicity folks were like, I hear it's going very well. And they showed up. And apparently Peter Guber, our big friend up at Sony, who didn't get the script at the beginning, was starting to insist on getting a producer credit on the movie because he heard it was great.
Mm-hmm. Sounds about right.
But according to editor Bruce Gannon, who would cut all of John Singleton's movies, we had a lot of freedom. It almost felt like an indie film. Sometimes studios can come in with a billion notes and take away the heart of a movie and milk it down, but that didn't happen on Boys, and that made it a special film.
Are we going to talk about the score? It's weird. That's my only bone to pick.
Well, okay. It's very like late 80s, early 90s. Yeah. So, and it's jazzy. It's jazzy. Lizzie's mentioning the score, and it's jazzy for a reason, because Stanley Clarke is a very famous bassist and jazz musician, and he was hired for a very specific reason. And it's because John Singleton met him on the set of Pee-wee's Playhouse.
There we go.
So
that's how he just cast his
man, good for him, man.
John Singleton.
Good for him. Loyal dude.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, he actually crossed paths with him twice. So Stanley Clarke, his first composing credit was for an episode of Pee-wee's Playhouse. And so that's where he first met Singleton. And then he was playing on the Arsenio Hall show as a jazz musician. And he meets John Singleton backstage. And John Singleton says, quote, you're going to do my movie one day. And I said, sure, kid. Less than a year later, I got a call to meet this guy at his office. I remember John was sitting on his couch playing something that looked like a Game Boy. And he said, remember me? And so that's when he knew he was scoring his film.
Remember me?
Yeah, he was working this thing from every angle. So he edits the movie, him and his editor, Bruce Gannon, and then they have to test the movie. And it's different when you're testing a movie like this than a typical, you know, Columbia Huat movie, because they were like, we have to test it for the white executives and make sure they like it. And then we have to test it for a white audience. And then we have to also test it for a black audience. And we have to see if this movie, it has to play in all three in order for them to support the movie after the fact. So Singleton first screens the movie for 10 executives at the DeMille Theater on the Sony lot. They're all like 50 years and older, all white. The next test screening is for an audience from South Central that they got bussed up to Sony. So first screening, Sony executives, huge success. Half of them are crying at the end. They're just like, this movie's great. We've never seen anything like it. This is going to be amazing. They then bring this audience up from South Central. They bring them up at 3 p.m. The screening's not until 5 p.m. They don't let them into the theater for 2 hours. It's cold. It's raining. As producer Steve Nicolaides later recounted, quote, they finally filled up the theater with a fairly pissed off audience, and the guy who ran the test programs got up and said, good evening, this is an unfinished work. When you see a white leader with squiggly lines, that indicates dissolve two. The sound is not perfect. A guy in the balcony said, shut the fuck up and start the fucking movie.
Oh, no.
But once it began, the excitement was so intense. It was like being at a Bruce Springsteen concert in the 1970s. It was amazing. So we knew. And apparently, coming out of the theater, so many of the audience members just went up to Singleton and were like, we didn't know you could do this.
Right.
Like, we didn't know this could be a movie. We didn't know this was a thing. I've never seen anything like this. Actually, the quote that came up again and again was mostly it was black men with their girlfriends, and the girlfriend had to do the talking because the black men couldn't speak. They were too emotional. And they couldn't speak.
Yeah. If they started talking about the movie, they would have cried.
They would have cried. Exactly. So it's like the girlfriend had to be like, I need to tell you how much this movie means to my boyfriend who can't talk right now. And like, that was the conversation.
He's literally holding in tears.
Yeah.
Aww.
Yeah. Apparently, though, there was one individual who was not won over by the first screening. And that was Ice Cube. As he later said on the Bill Simmons podcast, we did that movie and it was my first movie ever. And John showed me the movie before it was done. And if you ever see a movie before it's finished, you will say, this is garbage. It's unfinished, unpolished. It's like seeing a room right after they built it, but they don't put furniture in it or paint it. You're just like, what is this shit? That's kind of how I looked at it. I was so mad. I left, called my manager and said, I shouldn't have done this. I shouldn't have done this. She said, was it that bad? I said, it didn't have no music. There wasn't no sounds. It felt flat. You got to put all these sound effects in a movie. When a guy puts a cup down, you actually have to put that sound in or you won't hear it. You'll see it, but you won't hear it. So I was just disappointed. And I didn't want to have nothing to do with Boys in the Hood. I was like, damn, mistake, mistake, mistake. And John just kept saying, let me finish it. Will you let me finish it? I said, okay, all right. All right. I love the full circle of him convincing him to do the movie.
The other thing about, like, it's funny when you don't know movies well. Like, one of the things I say all the time is, like, sometimes people walk out of a movie and they're like, that movie was bad. But they don't know why it was bad. They just know it was bad. And they don't realize, like, so if you see a movie that's unfinished, like the edit isn't done, there's no music in it, you don't realize that music is making a movie until it's not there. And then you're like, why do I not care about this? Oh, because there's no music swell that's happening right now.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's no sound effects.
It had nothing. I mean, it was just like dry scene after dry scene.
Yeah, I'm sure like the tempo was off.
And all like the slow-mo at the end with like there were probably no gunshots. There was just like nothing, you know, in this movie. So Frank Price and Columbia, they're like, we have a movie that's going to resonate with Black audiences. We know it'll resonate with white audiences. How do we get white audiences to see this movie? So this is like going back to the marketing question. Okay, the solution is to take it to the whitest place, the Cannes Film Festival.
Oh.
So in 1991, they decide we're going to take Boys in the Hood from South Central to the Cannes Film Festival. And they rented billboards in Nice. And they covered them with graffiti, creating intrigue and buzz at the festival for this movie that no one had heard of, with a cast that no one had heard of, written and directed by a filmmaker no one had heard of. And so, for the first time in his life, John Singleton left Los Angeles to go to the Cannes Film Festival.
Oh, wow.
First time in his life.
He described the ride from the airport in France to Vanity Fair. Quote, Cube, this Ice Cube, and I'm not Cuba Gooding Jr. Apparently, his nickname was also Cube, and Ice Cube was just like, no, it's not. So, yeah, he got Cuba. Quote, Cube and I motioned to stop the car. We jump out, all excited, taking pictures in front of the posters. Then we turned and looked at the beach, and there is wall-to-wall women topless. There were various degrees of wannabe models flashing the best and worst European plastic surgery. I looked at Cube, and he looked at me. We just got back into the car and went to the Carlton. The execs were at the Hotel du Cap. When I was there, Schwarzenegger was holding court, Malcolm McDowell was telling jokes poolside, and Belinda Carlisle from the Go-Go's was walking around topless. So to add to all of this, the film's screening is attended by like Hollywood's black royalty, Wesley Snipes, Denzel Washington, Quincy Jones, Eddie Murphy, and of course, Spike Lee are all in attendance for the premiere of the film. And Ice Cube was terrified because the last time he saw it, it was terrible. And so here's his quote. I didn't see it again until we went to the Cannes Film Festival. I'm like, we're going to show this to a French audience? I went because as a career move, you go. But I'm like, we're going to show this to a French audience, man. For one thing, the subject matter, they're not going to get what the hell a 64 is and go get the 40 and all this. And the movie is flat. But when I saw it, it was completed and it just blew me away. It had subtitles, though, because it was for the French. I'm like, I love this movie, but these people probably hate this. And then they gave it a standing ovation at the end. They jumped up and clapped. Eddie Murphy was there and Quincy Jones. I was like, this is going to blow up. This was like the best thing I ever did. And I just love the highs and lows of Ice Cube on this like, movie.
This is the worst career move I have ever made. This is the best career move I have ever made.
Yep.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
So the movie debuted in the uncertain regard category, and it was actually a white critic who was kind of responsible for opening the film up to white audiences. And of course, that's Roger Ebert, who was there with his fiance, Chaz Hamill Smith, who is black, and he was blown away by the movie. He said, "It's one of the best American films of recent years. The movie is a thoughtful, realistic look at a young man's coming of age and also a human drama of rare power, Academy Award material. Singleton is a director who brings together two attributes not always found in the same film. He has a subject and he has style. The film is not only important, but also a joy to watch because his camera is so confident and he wins such natural performances from his actors. By the end of Boys in the Hood, I realized I had not simply seen a brilliant directorial debut, but an American film of enormous importance." And so that kind of kicked off the awards buzz for Boys in the Hood. The public screening at Cannes sold out. They had to turn away hundreds of people trying to get in. And Columbia Pictures smartly realized, we cannot go cheap on promoting this movie. So they set a July 12th nationwide release date, 850 theaters, and they spent $8 million on promotion and advertising for the film.
Whoa.
So they spent more than the film's budget on promoting it, which is great. And it was a smart move. Boys in the Hood premiered in Los Angeles on July 2nd, 1991. It opened wide across the United States 10 days later on July 12th, 1991. And that weekend, the Columbia Pictures executives were actually on a retreat in Santa Barbara. They're at this fancy hotel, according to Stephanie Elaine. We had some retreats that day. We were getting the numbers. They were really good. And everybody was happy. In fact, we did a little caravan where we drove out to some movie theaters in areas of Santa Barbara. They were packed. And we're like, oh my God, it worked, it worked, it worked. The implication being, if people in Santa Barbara are seeing the movie, it's resonating with white audiences.
Sure. The whitest place in the world. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. The excitement was short-lived. Again, Stephanie Elaine, quote, "That night, just as I was dozing off to sleep, Amy called me from her room and said, people are hurt, people are dying. And I literally went into shock. I was just so upset. And because the entire time, and even during the whole campaign, we just kept reiterating that the movie was made to increase the peace. The reason the movie was made was because we wanted to make a statement about kids in these situations and through Trey's journey, making the right choice." Now, what Elaine is alluding to is that there were a small number of breakouts of violence surrounding the film's release, including 33 injuries and one death outside theaters across the country during the opening weekend of the film. And it was reported on much in the same way, if you remember our episode on Do the Right Thing, as this foregone conclusion.
Yeah, that it would incite riots.
That a movie that included violence and young black men would incite violence amongst young black men.
Sure.
Of course, John Singleton pointed out a man was murdered at a screening of Godfather 3 during its release, presumably because somebody hated the movie that much, so they just killed somebody else. So apparently, John Singleton started getting a bunch of heat with all of these mostly white pundits saying, sure. Well, what do you expect? You know, you've shown black violence on screen, and now you're going to incite people in the streets to, you know, perform this violence on one another. And ironically, they're not talking about Terminator 2, in which I think like 65 people are killed and was released the same weekend as Boys in the Hood.
Right.
So New Jack City had been released, I guess, a few months prior. Again, there was like a fatal shooting outside of one of those theaters. So these fears seemed very fresh. But to quote my old professor, Dr. Todd Boyd, this is a very old thought that goes back basically 100 years. So as he said, this racist notion that black people would be unruly if they saw someone shot in a movie dates back to the days of boxer Jack Johnson in the early 1900s. People perpetuated the fear that if black people saw footage of Johnson beating white people, it would lead to black people slugging white people in the streets. The sense of how this movie is going to cause a riot, and when you look at the history of that, it's rooted in the sense that black people are really dumb and childlike and can't distinguish between fact and fiction. So the movie is going to start a riot, and chaos is just going to transpire because these people don't know this is a movie, and that was all just racist conjecture. Listen to more on our episode of Do the Right Thing for how that plagued Spike Lee's release of his film as well. Now, of course, Columbia Pictures had a decision to make, which was basically a lot of white pundits were saying you should pull the movie. And like police were saying you should pull the movie from theaters. They said no. And they said they were going to stand by the film. They said individual theater owners could, of course, decide if they wanted to screen the film or not. But we are just going to stand by our movie and we're not going to pull it. And financially, they certainly made the right decision. So Boys in the Hood opened first weekend, $10 million on a $6.5 million budget. It made $22 million in its first 2 weeks. As you mentioned in your podcast, John, it beat out the per screen average of Terminator 2.
Crazy.
Wow.
It ended its domestic run at $57.5 million. That's again on a budget of $6.5 million.
Whoa.
It was the most profitable movie of 1991.
Yeah.
This is a rated R film.
Rated R film with not only with no white cast and no name cast.
No
name.
Yeah.
John Singleton was 23 years old. Boys in the Hood was the first film about South Los Angeles with an all-black cast written and directed by a black filmmaker and bankrolled by a major Hollywood studio. 6 months later, John Singleton was nominated for Best Director. He was the first black man ever nominated for Best Director.
Wow.
He was also nominated for Best Original Screenplay. He remains the youngest person ever nominated for Best Director. Do you guys know who the second youngest person ever nominated for Best Director is?
No.
Orson Welles for Citizen Kane.
Wow.
Singleton was 3 years younger. He was 24 years old and 44 days.
Wow.
He lost Best Director to Lizzie, 91, movie we covered.
I have no idea.
The Silence of the Lambs.
I was going to guess that. Jonathan Demme, I should have gone for it.
He did. And he lost screenplay to Thelma and Louise. Boys was not nominated for Best Picture. As you guys discussed on your podcast, John, Best Picture was Silence of the Lambs, which won Beauty and the Beast, Bugsy, JFK, and The Prince of Tides. And no one has seen The Prince of Tides since 1991. Oh. This is apparently more common than I realized for a director to be nominated, but not their film. Actually, that same year, Ridley Scott was nominated for Best Director for Thelma and Louise, but the film was not nominated for Best Picture.
That's a crazy good year between Thelma and Louise, Boys in the Hood, and Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, and JFK's fine. I wouldn't watch Bugsy again at this point. I think, though, that the big snub was casting. Like, the cast got no recognition for this movie. It's wild.
That's crazy.
Just to give you an example, two nominations for actor in a supporting role went to Bugsy cast members, Harvey Keitel and Ben Kingsley. And I'm just like, come on. We didn't have anything for Lawrence Fishburne here? Or Ice Cube?
Yeah.
Ice Cube should have gotten it. So Boys in the Hood was shut out of all other categories.
I do wonder about Ice Cube. Like, why? Because this does stand out in terms of his credits as... like, this is a much more serious role than he seemed to pursue far beyond this. I mean, I know there's a couple others, but I just wonder why he didn't push farther in that direction. He is really, really good.
So he talked about in a couple interviews that I read how he was pretty uncomfortable with the emotional aspects of the story. So he when he had to cry on camera, that was a pretty big deal for him, apparently. And, you know, a pretty big struggle. And I'm not sure if he enjoyed it or not. What's interesting is, have you seen Higher Learning? John Singleton. So, like, he's in that, and that's a more serious role as well. And I don't know, maybe it was just like the financial success of Friday and stuff, and it fit in easier with his like rap persona and whatnot.
And he started producing those too. And
yeah,
that's true.
So, I mean, I think it's, well, I think it's
saying,
the control.
I would love to see it.
Perspective too. Like, if you're producing, you know what I mean? And like, whereas if you have to act in like a role like this, you're really giving yourself up to the control of the director, you know, at the end of the day. And it seems like he likes to do his own thing, maybe.
I think that's right.
Okay, so obviously Boys in the Hood, despite being snubbed, did serve as a pretty big career launch pad for a lot of the people involved. So the movie is credited somewhat infamously for spawning the, quote, hood film subgenre. So it was followed by Menace to Society, South Central, Strapped, Tales from the Hood, Fresh, and then, of course, Clockers was Spike Lee kind of trying to end the subgenre, and then the Wayans brothers killed it with Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood.
Yeah, because there's a lot of others, like Juice, Jason's Lyric, Paid in Full. I mean, there's just a lot,
And I think, in a way, when I first saw Boys in the Hood, I didn't understand that it was the movie that was first, if that makes sense. Like, I saw it as like, oh, it's one of these movies, right? And then you don't understand that actually wasn't, that's not why it was made. It's, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's not what it's saying, et cetera.
Right.
And it's important to understand the context that it was made in. For John Singleton, this movie that at first seemed to be just the extremely promising beginning to a meteoric career would unfortunately become the apex of his career and represent a high that he would never quite reach again, neither commercially nor critically.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
From this film, and again, Singleton's 24, 25 when this is happening. He goes on to make Poetic Justice with Janet Jackson and Tupac Shakur, and that's trying to tell a female story, like a female South Central story. It wasn't a flop, but it was not super successful. Mixed reviews. It was not the incendiary, like, you know, oh my God, look at this movie that Boys in the Hood was. It's like a slower, more thoughtful film. It's like much more sensitive. It's obviously far less like masculine in its energy. I don't know if people knew exactly what to think about it at the time. And then obviously he did Higher Learning, which we talked about, and that touches on like white supremacy very directly and Nazism. And again, like, it was financially successful, not to the level of Boys in the Hood, but mixed critical reviews, not quite the same level. And then in 1997, he did Rosewood, and that was a historical drama inspired by the Rosewood Massacre in Florida in 1923. Basically, a mob of white people just murdered a bunch of black people and destroyed their town. John Voight. It was his best received movie critically since Boys in the Hood, but then it just flopped at the box office. And so it like was kind of this 90s. And again, he, by the end of this decade, he's like 30 years old.
Yeah. And the other thing to note is that even when something like Rosewood does well critically, it's not doing well in the awards circuit.
That's right.
And so, and like, because a lot of these like auteur directors outside of like Steven Spielberg, like a lot of them make movies that don't make money. Like yep. they're not hits, but they're supported by like, well, they're getting nominated for Oscars and they're like considered like prestige and like studios want to work with them.
At times, it's even a badge of honor if it's not making money.
Right.
In a like perverse way.
Yeah. And it's like, well, they, you know, one for them and one for us. And it's like, we get to make the other, you know, and it's interesting. It's like, you don't get the same level of criticism. Like, John Singleton is like making movies about the things that he knows, and they're different movies, but it's like, people are like, well, we've already seen that. And it's like, okay, how many Scorsese movies are about the
Gangsters.
Italian mafia?
Yeah, exactly.
But you can make that into eternity. Like, he's literally still making it, and like people are like, well, I mean, we gotta see it. You know,
gotta see The Irishman.
Yeah,
it's 3 hours.
And, that, and I'm not trying to like, I'm not saying like I obviously love a lot of those movies, but it's just like, it's just one of those things where, you know, there is a stark difference. And when you don't have that support and you're trying to be a Black auteur filmmaker, it's pretty difficult because you're not getting the awards and you're not getting the box office success, you know? So, yeah.
It's such a good point, too, that what you just made, that there's like the variety of stories is not accepted in the same way, that it's almost like there's one story that is expected and pictured, and that once you've done that, you don't get to explore nuances in the same way that we see a lot of these white directors and writers able to do. And I feel like we're almost just starting to see that happening, where there are more nuances allowed, there are more experiences allowed to be shown. And it's amazing, but also just insane that we haven't seen that before. And that's something I think that Boys in the Hood did that I was just blown away by, is it doesn't show, like, it shows such a wide variety of experiences and lives just within that one community. And I think that's kind of what makes it such an incredible movie.
Yep.
Yeah, on those points, like, one person who, by the way, I think is like an incredibly talented director, but a great example of what you're saying, John, is Damien Chazelle, where like First Man and Babylon, look, I enjoyed those movies. I think he's an amazing director. Those movies hemorrhaged money.
Right.
And but were absolutely supported by the Academy, you know, and by the Hollywood sort of prestige circuit, you would say. And then, Lizzie, to your point, I think with Boys in the Hood, it's like, in a weird way, white people hadn't seen it before, but I think it was also close enough. Like you're saying, John, it's like you have colors. And then so like white people kind of are like, ooh, maybe there's something here. And then they see Boys in the Hood and they're like, oh my God, like this is crazy, blah, blah, blah. And then you followed up with like Poetic Justice and they're like, I saw that. I saw those movies. So what's interesting is then Singleton goes back to Blaxploitation in 2000 and he does Shaft. He does the reboot of Shaft. And then he does Baby Boy in 2001, which is kind of like a spiritual successor to Boys in the Hood in a lot of ways. It almost feels like it's telling the story of Furious Styles, like right, like 20 years before, you know what I mean? When he's first having a kid. And then you do Too Fast, Too Furious. He's like on a big franchise, makes a bunch of money there. He finances and produces Hustle and Flow. And so like, it's definitely like kind of an upswing in his career. He does Four Brothers, which is a really weird movie, but very successful.
Fun.
Yeah, fun movie. Like Marky Mark and Tyrese Gibson. And
Chiwetel Ejiofor playing a really cool bad guy.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
I had a big crush on Garrett Hedlund, so I saw that one in the theaters.
Yeah, he's a cute guy. But then his film career kind of gets basically put on ice with this really weird moment where he directs 2011's Taylor Lautner action vehicle Abduction, which I've never seen. I don't think a lot of people saw it.
I have seen that, though I honestly cannot tell you anything about it.
Yeah.
Other than I definitely saw it.
Oh, Taylor.
It is technically written by an Academy Award winning writer.
I didn't know that he's directed that. That's hilarious.
Yeah, so Sean Christensen, who won the Oscar for a short film called Curfew, wrote the script. I think it was a spec script. It was designed as a vehicle for Taylor Lautner. Taylor Lautner's dad was a producer on the movie, and John Singleton directed it. I could not find very much information on like what drew him to the project. You know what I mean? Or he didn't say much about it, positively or negatively. But it was the last movie he ever directed.
Wow.
He apparently was the first choice to direct Straight Outta Compton, which makes sense.
Yeah.
However, that job went to F. Gary Gray. He then was attached to direct a Tupac biopic. Again, he worked with Tupac on Poetic Justice, and Baby Boy was supposed to be Tupac before he died. And then it was Tyrese Gibson after that. But that movie fell apart. And so then he went to direct TV, and he was directing Billions. And then he co-created Snowfall on FX.
And Empire, I think, right? I think he was affiliated with Empire as well.
He was, yeah. He directed at least one episode in the first season, but he was not involved in the creation of the show, I don't believe. But Snowfall was the last big thing that he did. And it was kind of almost his biggest success since Boys in the Hood in some ways, because it went six seasons. And after a rocky first season, kind of had universal acclaim, but it ended in the spring of 2023. So it's like a really unusual run over the last decade. And then, of course, on April 17th, 2019, John Singleton suffered a stroke. He was placed in intensive care, taken off life support on April 28th, 2019. He was only 51 years old.
Oh, man.
And if you think about, you know, Scorsese still directing at 82 or however old he is now, or Clint Eastwood at 179. it's, you know, you do think about the number of movies he could, you think about this person at 23 directing Boys in the Hood. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. But like, you know, just like, just going over it again, it's like, there wasn't, you know, and even Spike has had a hard time, mm-hmm. obviously, like making films. He's obviously been able to have a comeback in certain levels. But like, yeah, man, it's tough because it's like the 90s, like I said, was like a time where they were making a lot of black films, but they were for black audiences. And even though he was nominated, the Academy, for the most part, was like, you know, and... Mm-hmm. And like when you have that and like you're not doing huge box office success, it's just like where do you go, what do? And that's why you don't have a lot of black auteur directors until mm-hmm. very recently, mm-hmm. you know, like you have directors that who work maybe consistently, like a Tim Story, you know, but like
yeah, you got like Antoine Fuqua,
yeah,
like
Antoine Fuqua,
F. Gary Gray, but those are, they're not writer directors, they're not, like you're saying, they're not the auteur guy.
Yeah.
You know.
And that's not to say anything about their skill level. I'm just like how people perceive you, you know,
yeah.
And like, that's what, you know, it's unfortunate that's what it is, but it is. Cause I even think about Spike, like, you know, like he made Malcolm X and it's like, you get barely any nominations for that film. And you're just like, I don't know. At a certain point you go like, well, I don't know. And you know, we talk all the time about how much awards matter, but they do matter when it comes to getting money to make movies. And like, mm-hmm. you can only self-finance for so long.
No, I mean, Spike Lee had to self-finance / crowdfund The Blood of Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. This is someone two decades into a remarkable career, and he's scrounging it together, like you're saying. And we will cover Malcolm X at some point because it's an amazing movie. And it's like, that's a crazy Oscars snub. And I just want to end on this note. Boys in the Hood was inducted into the Library of Congress in 2001. Spike Lee, in a missive memorializing Singleton, wrote of that first time they met, quote, "Over the many years, people have told me I'm going to be a filmmaker. When John said that to me the first time we met, I believed him right away. It was no surprise."
Yeah.
End quote. And with that, we're going to end our coverage of Boys in the Hood.
Well, here on this podcast, Jonathan, we do always like to wrap it out with a what went right. And I feel like we've got to touch on that with everybody. So maybe if it's okay, we'll start with you. What went right for you on this movie?
I mean, so much. I think it's just an incredible film and obviously helped like super launch careers of, you know, some of the most famous and greatest Black actors like Lawrence Fishburne, Angela Bassett, and, you know, Morris Chestnut, and like every, like Cuba Gooding Jr., all these people are like incredible. Ice Cube, obviously. And it showed, I think the thing that Boys in the Hood did like similarly to Do the Right Thing was like show Black directors and actors and writers that like, hey, you can make, there's a place for us here, and like you can do stuff, and it's very inspirational. Yeah. It all went right.
Totally. Yeah. Showing the possibility is such a huge benefit. I gotta go with Ice Cube.
You took mine.
I'm sorry. I knew he was very funny. I knew he was fun to watch. I had no idea he could do this. And I just couldn't look away from him. I think he was incredible. And I would love to see more.
Then I will switch mine to Stephanie Elaine, who, you know, she's the one who brought the script up the chain at Columbia. And it seems like, and she's an incredible producer. She's extremely successful now. Pretty sure she has an overall deal with Endeavor Content and has had a wonderful career. So kudos to her. She also is one of the people responsible for discovering Robert Rodriguez. Like, she'll show up in some of her other projects as well.
Thank you so much for joining us for this. This was really fun.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Of course.
John, anything you want to plug?
Of course, our podcast, Black Men Can't Jump in Hollywood. If you like movies, we talk about movies of leading Black actors, and it's fun. It's not all serious. It's also comedic. We're comedians, so can't help ourselves. Yeah, and you can follow me, John Braylock, I guess. I do shows every now and then. That's it.
Follow him. Listen to him. You know him. You love him. Go check out more.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, John.
Thank you.
Check out Boys in the Hood on Netflix.
Yes, gotta watch it.
Check out Black Men Can't Jump in Hollywood. All right, guys. As always, we need to give a shout out to our Full Stop supporters. We gotta give a shout out to Ellen Singleton, Jewish Reese Samant, Lachlan Morrow, Scott Gerwin, Sadie, just Sadie, Chris Leal, Matthew Pelton, Steve Winterbauer, unrelated, Don Scheibel, Rosemary Southward, Tom Kristen, Hannah, just Hannah, Nathan Orloff, Soman Chainani, and Michael McGrath, thank you for all you do. And thank you to all of our patrons at the $50 tier, the $5 tier, the $1 tier, or even you freebie hangers-on that I don't even know why you're on there, to be honest. But we appreciate you anyway.
We certainly do. And as a reminder, this episode was the result of a poll. If you join our Patreon for at least the $1 tier and up, you too can vote on polls and tell Chris what the next movie is that he or I should do.
Mostly me.
Mostly Chris. I'm not going to lie.
Lizzie doesn't like participating in those.
That's not true. The timing hasn't worked out yet. But okay. Please join so that you can exercise your right to vote in the only election that matters, and that is our Patreon polls. So we will see you in 2 weeks for a very special episode that I am very excited about, and also it's a bit daunting to cover, but that, good people, is The Crow. So, okay, well, it's not, it's a very serious episode. So that's a good taste of what's to come, and we will talk to you then.
Bye.
Go to patreon.com/whatwentwrongpodcast to support What Went Wrong and check out our website at whatwentwrongpod.com. What Went Wrong is a Sad Boom podcast presented by Lizzie Bassett and Chris Winterbauer. Editing and music by David Bowman.